Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Sarah Manning-Peskin about the new book, A Molecule Away from Madness, Tales of a Hijacked Brain. A neurologist regales listeners with extraordinary stories of the brain under siege. Cognitive neurologist Sarah Manning-Peskin demystifies the most curious neurological phenomena through the perspective of patients, researchers, and science. A Molecule Away from Madness offers a captivating singular view of the human brain. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Galina. It's so nice to be with you.
So I would like to start by asking, how has this pandemic influenced you and your work?
So it's a great question. I'm a cognitive neurologist. So most of the patients I see are coming in with complaints about changes in memory or behavior or language. And it actually turned out that many of our appointments were pretty easily compatible with virtual settings. So we do quite a bit more virtual medicine now than we ever did before. And it's been, in some ways, a nice learning experience. And even now that we're back seeing most of our patients in person, we've been able to preserve some telemedicine visits. It's been really useful for a lot of people.
And you yourself, did you have to stop traveling, for example? Are you getting back into it?
So actually, we hadn't traveled for a long time, and we just traveled to South Africa about 2 weeks ago, and that was the first trip we'd taken since the pandemic started. So it felt a little bit surreal to be in an airport again. Our son, who's four, we realized had never been on an escalator. And now we're starting to ease back into normalcy, which feels good.
So can you tell us more about yourself?
So I grew up outside Boston and was there for most of my life through college. And then I came down to Philadelphia to Penn for medical school. And then I've been here ever since.
And how did you get interested in studying medicine?
So initially, I actually had wanted to be a scientist. So in college, I worked in a laboratory that I loved. It was a biochemistry laboratory, and we worked on looking at the shell that bacteria create to help protect themselves. And we looked at how bacteria create it and how do they recycle the materials. And I loved the work at the time. And so I left college with a plan of trying to start my own laboratory. And I applied to combined programs where you actually get a MD and a PhD as part of one program, and ended up coming down to Philadelphia. And I started the program, and I got about a year into the, you do the beginning of medical school, and then I got about a year into the PhD portion, and realized that I actually loved writing about science, and I loved writing about research, and I loved creating the proposals, but I didn't actually want to be the one growing vats of bacteria and plating things on petri dishes. And so I ended up quitting my PhD and finishing medical school. And then as an intern, you had to do 2 months of night float where you're on only at nights. And it's lonely. And sometimes there are quiet times. And that's when I started writing, and things sort of evolved from there.
And how did you get interested in brain?
So once I went back to medical school and realized I had to choose something, I realized that the diseases that I was most interested in were the ones that caused these wild personality altering effects, where they essentially created one person from another. You could sort of imagine, a typical couple who goes to couples therapy, and one person says, this isn't the person I married. These are conditions where molecularly that's very much true, where it changes people's identities. And I was just sort of fascinated by how they work from a scientific perspective, and also the social implications of these conditions, because they're very much sort of whole family diseases. It's not a broken arm where you treat one person and that's about it. These are conditions where we really essentially treat entire families.
You have a really fascinating career journey. So I was wondering, were there any mentors or your colleagues that were very supportive along the way?
Yeah, I've been incredibly lucky where I've had lots of people who have helped me along the way, because I didn't really know where I was going for a long time. When I was in college, the laboratory I worked in was Dan Kahn's laboratory, and he was wonderful. And he had actually had sort of a circuitous route in getting to be a basic science professor. And so that was a good role model for me to see how, changing careers can be joyful and wonderful and successful. And then when I was working on research at Penn, I was in Rahul Kohli's lab, and he also was just, he was fantastic. And when I remember going to talk to him and saying that I thought I was going to quit my PhD, and he had put resources into me, he'd spent time training me, and he just sort of saw me as a whole person, was very quick to say, I can understand that it sounds like this is right for your life. And he just was incredibly compassionate and was a wonderful mentor for me, just beyond just the basic science bench. And then when I've been in medicine, I've just had some wonderful people who have led me along the way, which I don't think I could name all of them, but most recently, I was sort of trained by Maury Grossman, who's an expert on frontotemporal dementia, and Dave Wolk, who's an expert on Alzheimer's disease, and Dina Jacobs, and Mike Rubenstein, and a whole slew of other folks.
You are in this unique position to have the scientific background and also medical background, so you're kind of marrying these two together. So I was wondering if you could comment on how has this helped you in medicine?
I think it's given me an understanding of the fact that all of these medicines that we use come from these basic science resources. And one of the problems that we've sort of run into is that you have lots of basic scientists and you have lots of doctors. And we've been working for years at increasing communication between those two groups of people. The whole purpose of MD-PhD programs is to smooth out that pathway between the research bench and the bedside with patients. And so I think, even though I never finished the MD-PhD program, I think it gave me a sense of that trajectory between research and basic science and animal models going into actual patient translational studies and then going into just regular practice in the clinic.
And what would you say to our younger listeners and students or early career researchers?
So I think what I would tell them was what I wish I had felt better about when I was younger, which is that it's okay to change directions. And I remember when I was trying to decide whether or not to quit my PhD, feeling like it was such a huge decision. And then I watched actually a TED Talk that talked about that when decisions are really difficult, it often means that both options are probably, you know, okay. And that was some of the best piece of advice that I remember ever getting. And it turned out that doing a shift in my career and changing focus turned out to be one of the most fulfilling things that that I've done. I love what I do now, and having part of my time be clinical and in clinical research and part of my time being writing. And it's totally different than what I thought I would be doing, you know, 10 years ago.
So you can really see the passion for both those things in your book, for brain and for writing. And your book is A Molecule Away from Madness, Tales of a Hijacked Brain. Can you tell us, how did you come to writing it?
So I've always been fascinated by these patients with these unusual diseases that change their personalities. And I think I wanted to share the stories and try to capture what is it like to live with these diseases, both for the patients, but also for their families. You know, what is it like to be married to someone who acts completely different than what they used to and has no insight? Yeah, you know, what is it like to be, you know, a parent to someone who's become suddenly psychotic and you can't figure out why? And then I also wanted to be a bit of a entertainer in telling the stories of these scientists who figured out the molecules that were causing these diseases. And these are, you know, oftentimes heroic people who were, in many cases, totally ostracized. They were, you know, made fun of. People didn't trust them. And they turned out to be correct. Yeah, but they went through a rough time in many cases.
All right, so let's delve into some of the science that you cover in your book, and we can start with the basics. Can you tell us, what are the neurons?
So neurons are the sort of primary cell that we think of when we think of what connects our brains to the rest of our bodies and what helps us think. And so the brain actually has lots of neurons, and then it has lots of other supportive cells. But neurons are really the main drivers of our cognition.
And how are they organized on the sort of higher levels?
So different parts of the brain tend to do different things. And we are learning more about this every day. And every day we figure out that things are even more connected than we ever realized. But in general, we think of different parts of the brain having roughly different sort of jobs. So the front of the brain is often helpful with getting us to initiate activities, giving us motivation. It also actually helps us with our controlling our impulses. And then it helps us with sort of multitasking and organization and judgment. The sides of our brain, called the temporal lobes, those are often helpful in language, particularly on the left side for most people. And they also, the medial temporal lobes, which are sort of, if you draw a line from ear to ear, about a third of the way in each side, are memory structures that help us remember things, in particular with our short-term memory. In the back of the brain, there are areas that help us interpret what we see. So your eyes pick up information, they pick up light that's coming in from the outside world, and all that information gets sent to the back of the brain where we make sense of it. And then sort of the back at the top of the brain is something called the parietal lobes. And those help us with sort of some visuospatial function. And they help us also with some calculations, knowing our left from our right, and helping us understand sort of how to perform complex actions, like using a fork and knife or using a can opener, things like that.
And what do we know about the mechanisms on how these cells communicate between each other?
So it's a great question. In some sense, we know a lot, and in some sense, there's much that we don't know. So neurons communicate with each other. They're not all connected directly. So it used to be thought that the nervous system was made of one giant cell. And you can imagine that's the easiest concept, because if you have to get a signal from your brain to your toes, wouldn't it be easiest if it was just a giant cell that went all the way down? But it turns out actually that the nervous system has lots of different cells. And in order to communicate from one neuron to the next, they actually use chemicals. So they actually send out little molecules that then are detected by the next neuron. And that's how the signals are transmitted for the most part.
So what are the ways that these processes could go wrong or awry?
So there are lots of ways for it to go wrong. And that's part of what I wrote about in the book is I divided the sort of mechanisms into four buckets, which are mutants, rebels, invaders, and evaders. And mutants were DNA level changes, and rebels were abnormal proteins or sort of recalcitrant proteins. And invaders were things that were not supposed to be there that end up invading the brain. And evaders are molecules that are supposed to be there that are conspicuously absent.
So what do you mean when you say molecule?
It's a great question. So a molecule is just a collection of connected atoms. You could sort of think of it as a bunch of tiny Lego blocks clicked together.
So you mentioned these categories that you sort of put these different molecules into. And can we start with the first one, the mutants? So what kind of issues can the mutants cause in brain?
So again, so these are mutants. They're changes in DNA. And some of the examples that I wrote about in the book, one of them was Huntington's disease. So that's a condition that causes people to have these sort of writhing, sort of dance-like movements that they can't control in their limbs. And it also causes people to have cognitive issues, to develop dementia. And that's a condition that turns out is caused by a change in people's DNA in a particular location. And that was actually discovered in part by a woman named Nancy Wexler, who has sort of a fascinating story. She was a brilliant woman who did a Fulbright scholarship and was off after finishing the scholarship. She was off in Europe, and her dad gives her a call and says, could you come home for my birthday? And she's sort of skeptical. She says, you know, that's unusual for him to ask me to come home for his birthday. But she flies home anyways. And her dad sits her down along with her sister and says, your mom has Huntington's disease. And at the time, she was about to start a PhD program in psychology. And she ends up sort of overhauling her whole life and doing her PhD on Huntington's disease. And then she turns to trying to find the place in our genome, so trying to find the piece of DNA that causes Huntington's disease. And at the time, there was one source that I found that says she's taken one biology class. When I spoke with her sister, she said she doesn't think she'd taken any. But despite that, she had this incredible drive. So she creates these workshops where she brings together scientists from all these different fields, and they come up with this idea for how to find the gene that causes Huntington's disease, and they're ultimately successful. And their technique ends up being used for thousands of other diseases in finding the genetic cause of these conditions. So it really revolutionizes not only the field of Huntington's disease, but actually the entire field of genetics.
So is it always the case that sort of mutant part of the disease is the hereditary, or can it be sporadic as well?
So it could be either. So you're exactly right. So sometimes people will have a mutation that they've gotten from their parents. And oftentimes, depending on the type of mutation, but sometimes we'll have cases where someone will develop symptoms. Someone will develop difficulty with speaking. And we'll say, you know, has anyone had anything like this? And they'll say, oh, yeah, you know, my parent had something similar at around the similar age. Or my parent had some similar, you know, behavior changes around the same age. So sometimes things are genetic, so there's a DNA level change and they're inherited. But there's also something called sporadic mutations. And that's where in development, so in the womb, very early on, someone has a mutation in their DNA that happens when you're copying your DNA to create more cells to grow your as a baby, so to grow the fetus. And so in that case, people will have a mutation in their DNA, but actually their family doesn't have it. So they would be at risk of passing that on to their children, even though no one in the previous generation had it.
So how advanced are we in detection of these mutations nowadays?
So in some cases, we're really good at it. So we know that every case of Huntington's disease is caused by a change in the same piece of DNA. We even know what that change typically looks like. So we know exactly where to look when we're concerned about Huntington's disease. There are other conditions, though, where we don't know exactly where to look, or where we think that there are multiple genes involved, where each one sort of confers a little bit of an increased risk or a little bit of a decreased risk, and we're not as good at calculating on a sum total how does someone's genetic profile sort of add up for a particular condition. So you could take something like Alzheimer's disease, where it's, we think it's a combination of, you know, genetics and environment for most people. And so other than a very small portion of folks who have Alzheimer's disease that's caused by a single, you know, genetic mutation, for most people, I can't point to a gene that's causing their symptoms.
So now going to the next category, and I'm glad that you mentioned Alzheimer's. So what about proteins that can go bad?
So the second category was the second part of the book was about REBLs. And these are proteins that are essentially supposed to help us, and turns out they turn on us and they target our brains. And in particular, I start off talking about conditions where the immune system goes awry, and these proteins called antibodies that we often use to attack, you know, bacteria or viruses that are invading us, instead actually attack our own brains. And so one of the stories I talk about is a woman who was, she's highly educated, highly successful. She finishes elite university, comes home, and wakes up one morning and asks her mom what's for breakfast. She goes back to sleep. And then she wakes up again, asks her mom the same question, what's for breakfast? Her mom thinks it's a little unusual. She goes back to sleep. She wakes up again, asks the same question. And by that time, her mom is thinking, you know, something is up. And she ends up getting a bit unsteady on her feet, and she gets a fever, and her mom takes her to the hospital, and they're sitting in the waiting room, and she suddenly attacks the doctor who's there, and lots of security guards have to come and restrain her, and she becomes just psychotic. She had been watching a show called The Walking Dead prior to the episode, and she starts to believe that she's living in The Walking Dead. So she starts to call people who she sees by names of characters in the show. Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of a terrifying situation. And she gets admitted to the hospital. Doctors can't figure out what's going wrong. Everything seems to look normal. And her mom finds this article about a condition where the immune system attacks the brain. And eventually she convinces the team to transfer her to a different hospital, where they send off the test to look for this disease. And it turns out she has this condition. And remarkably, there is a treatment. So she actually receives medications that suppress her immune system. And she has actually a surgery to take out the tumor that they actually had no idea existed, but it turns out was probably causing her symptoms. And she actually does quite well, and she goes back to, you know, her academic pursuits.
That is a terrifying story.
But pretty amazing that we can treat these conditions, that people can get better.
So talking about getting better, many of our listeners would be familiar with scrapie disease, which affects sheep particularly, and sometimes can cause human disease as well. So can you tell us, what do we know about that?
Yeah, so these are these fascinating collection of diseases where a protein actually acts like an infection. So you have a protein that, proteins are really complicated. They have to have a really specific three-dimensional structure in order to work. And there are some proteins where they can misfold in a particularly dangerous type of way, and then they cause proteins that are around them to do the same thing. They basically recruit followers, and it can cause a dramatic and lethal condition. And this was first sort of discovered in a disease called Kuru, that was this remarkable condition that affected women and children in this remote part of Papua New Guinea. And the people who came down with the condition, they would get really unstable. They'd have trouble walking. Their speech would get slurred. They often would sort of laugh uncontrollably, even though, you know, nothing was funny. And it was obviously a serious situation. And they would die within a year or so. And nobody could figure out what was happening. And ultimately, through some very sort of innovative and impressive researchers, they actually connected that disease, which they called Kuru, to scrapie, a similar disease in sheep, and to a disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is a similar disease in humans. And it turned out that all of these conditions were caused by proteins that would act like infections and cause lots of other proteins to misfold, and that's what caused the disease. And in the case of Kuru, which was this condition in Papua New Guinea, it turned out the condition was transmitted because people had a habit of cannibalism, where when people would die, they would actually, other people in the tribe would eat the brains. And typically it was the women and children who were eating the brains of these people who had passed away. And that's how the disease was transmitted from one person to another.
So how was Kuru stopped?
So eventually they actually figured out what was causing it. So they figured out the connection to cannibalism, and cannibalism was outlawed. And then the cases went down.
Oh, this is fascinating. So it was completely wiped out the cause of the disease.
Yeah, as far as we know, there are no new cases of Kuru. There are still cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. That's the related condition, and that we don't really know why that disease happens to some people and not others in most cases. But Kuru was essentially wiped out after we figured out the connection with cannibalism.
And what are the ways to diagnose Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease nowadays?
So for a long time, it was really hard to diagnose. Yeah, but there are some features. If you look at a particular type of MRI, sometimes you'll see a ribbon of brightness around the edge of the brain. Or if you look at an EEG, which is a test of the electricity in the brain, there is a particular pattern that you see that's sort of like a metronomic repeating pattern. And then if you look at the fluid that bathes the brain and the spinal cord, there were some particular tests that people could send. But until relatively recently, those tests were not great. But then actually there's a new test that was developed in more recent times that's actually become the gold standard. It's a test on spinal fluid. So that's how we diagnose it now. That's what we think of as the gold standard. People do have to be particularly careful when they're extracting that spinal fluid because we do worry that it can be infectious. And so we have to have people take extra precautions when they're doing it.
Really, truly fascinating. And perhaps visceral aspects of these two first categories that you describe is that something goes wrong with our body itself. So both DNA or proteins sort of getting bad. Now, what about the next categories? So who are the invaders?
So the invaders are things that shouldn't be in our body that end up invading our body. So DNA and proteins, we always have those. Yeah, but these are things that we put into our bodies. There are toxins and often medications. Yeah, so one of the examples I talk about in the book is there's a theory that Abraham Lincoln might have had mercury poisoning. There's a lot of secondhand accounts suggesting that he took a medication that contained a lot of mercury. And we know that mercury can cause people to be they can cause people to be aggressive. It can cause people to have difficulty sleeping. It can cause people to become antisocial. And we think of Lincoln as being this sort of even-keeled, thoughtful, non-volatile character. But there are these instances of him being relatively volatile. And there is some thought that, could that have been related to mercury poisoning? We can never prove it. And so we'll never really know. But it's an interesting sort of idea.
Is this also the case with lead?
So it's a great question. So lead is an example of a environmental toxin that can invade the body and can wreak havoc.
So it sounds like it's also a case of the public health necessity to really control these substances, and especially like metals that can be neurotoxic.
Yeah, exactly. It's extraordinarily difficult to do in some ways because it can be really hard to figure out exactly what environmental toxins are causing problems. It's a difficult epidemiological study to conduct. But you're exactly right. And certainly in some ways we've been successful in figuring out these conundrums because we have laws now about, lead and paint and things like that.
So you also write about molecules such as vitamins. So can you describe how and why are they important for our brain?
So vitamins are a set of molecules that are critical for us to have in our body, and we have to get them from our diets. And so the story, or one of the stories I tell about vitamins is about a condition called pellagra. And this became a problem in the early 1900s in the southeastern U.S. There was this huge epidemic of pellagra where hundreds of thousands of people were coming down with the condition. Many of them were dying from it. And it causes a remarkable dementia. It causes a gruesome rash, and it causes an upset stomach. And nobody could figure out what's causing the condition. And there was this idea floating around that it was an infection. And the disease tended to affect poor people. And so for a lot of people, that felt sort of like an easy explanation, because we could say, well, you know, it's poor people's fault. They don't have good sanitation, and they brought the disease on themselves. And then the Surgeon General ends up calling on this guy, Joseph Goldberger. And Goldberger was a man who was born at the foot of the Carpathian Mountains, came to the U.S. at age 9, speaking almost no English. He works his way up to become a physician or doctor. He ends up trying to hang a shingle, but just can't make enough money. So he joins the public health service. And he goes all around the country, all around the world. He contracts typhus and typhoid and yellow fever. He's really in the trenches. And the Surgeon General calls on Goldberger and says, you know, why don't you figure out this problem of pellagra? And Goldberger starts looking at the literature, and he figures out that this isn't at all caused by an infection. Actually, it's caused by a vitamin or a nutritional deficiency. He gets a lot of pushback, because then the story, instead of it being, well, poor people have brought it on themselves because of their sanitation practice, it's actually that we're starving our own people. It's a totally different, you know, it's different optics. So he gets a lot of resistance to his idea. And eventually he says, you know, I'm going to prove to you that this is not an infectious disease. So he goes to a clinic that has patients with pellagra, and he ends up doing sort of a stomach churning experiments. He scrapes off scales from their rash. He takes samples of their stool. He takes samples of their urine. He takes blood samples, and he exposes himself and a few other volunteers to all of it. So he forms it into capsules and swallows it. He injects some of the blood into his shoulder. He rubs some of their mucus on his own nose. It's just these, you know, graphic experiments. Ooh. Even his wife volunteered for them. And in the end of it, he says, you know, considering the amount of filth that we took in, we did pretty well, and none of us got pellagra. And so it's not an infectious disease. And ultimately, he figures out that it's it is a nutritional problem, and it's a deficiency in a vitamin. And he dies before they can figure out exactly which vitamin it is.
So this also led to inclusion of some of these vitamins and nutrients in food as well, hasn't it?
It has. So right now, many vitamins are actually added to things like flour and cereal. So vitamin deficiencies now are much more uncommon than they used to be. And it turns out actually that even though lots of people will take vitamin supplements, in most cases, we don't really need them, because usually we're getting enough of those vitamins in our food.
And what about evaders?
So the evaders were the vitamins. So these are the molecules where we need them and they're not there. So something like vitamins where we need to have them.
Oh, yes, that's right. So what is the part of patients in all of these stories? So how prominent is their role in sort of figuring out what's wrong? And do we have better relationships with patients nowadays?
This is a great question. I could tell you in our own clinic, when I see patients, in many cases, aside from trying to figure out what is the molecule that I think is related or causing their disease, I also try to figure out, are there research trials that they might qualify for? Because, you know, we don't have a cure for Alzheimer's disease or another condition called Lewy body disease or another condition called frontotemporal dementia. And we're only going to figure out a cure if we have patients who participate in research projects. That's the only way we're going to find it. And so that's a big part of our clinic is offering that opportunity to patients.
looking at all of these stories from, well, near and far past, we can see the different way of how scientists worked in those days. So how has the culture changed in a way that we will still want to figure out things, but we need to take into account much different social settings?
So I think certainly in terms of ethics, the landscape now is totally different than it was before. The guy who figured out the cause of pellagra, he actually, one of the other experiments he did, he was trying to prove that if you change someone's diet, you could cause pellagra. And he did that by going to a prison in Missouri and saying, you know, if anyone wants to volunteer for this experiment, you can get out of jail, essentially. So you can get out of prison if you participate. And we're going to feed you all these things. And he basically named all these delicious foods that were essentially only carbohydrates, didn't have many, high vitamin content. He got like 80 volunteers, ended up taking 12 of them. And he fed them essentially a carbohydrate-only diet for about 6 months or so, and proved that many of them came down with a disease that they thought was pellagra. And they get pardoned, but essentially, you know, something like that would obviously never be approved now. And there's an article about the end of that study where these people go into the governor's office to get their pardon. And the Jackson Daily News runs this article that says they ate their way to freedom. So that's something that, you know, you could never have something like that now, for clear reasons. And so the ethical landscape is obviously, you know, totally different. We're so much more careful about valuing autonomy and making sure that patients are making decisions with informed consent. So that's been a huge change over the course of the history that I've written about in the book. And the other big change, I think, is the gender of the researcher. So much of the research that was done in the early 1900s, it's essentially all men, because that was the main population in scientific spheres. Whereas more recently, there is such a huge burst of women in science, and the balance is very much switching.
So what are some of the ways that researchers try to sort of go around these issues, like ethical issues, and what kind of techniques are they starting to employ, maybe using VR, for example, in some cases?
So it's a great question. I think right now the way that we try to navigate ethical issues is to have an institutional review board. So we have outside people telling us, you know, what's okay and what's not okay. And there's a huge emphasis on making sure that patients understand what they're signing up for. Yeah, but I don't know of any particular things like VR specifically for use of for sort of increasing ethical practice. It's a great question. I've never thought about it before.
And thinking about the challenges in the field, especially when it comes to molecules like psychedelics. So how far are we from sort of very good and standardized ways to research them to really see what kind of benefits they can bring?
So research on psychedelics is becoming more popular, and I do think we're making headway in trying to find some outlets where they do seem to be helpful in particular conditions. And the way that we're figuring that out is by studying them in settings that are relatively controlled. And that's, I think, particularly important in terms of being able to interpret the results. Yeah, but psychedelics are sort of it's a contentious issue for obvious reasons, and it's controversial, and I think a lot more work needs to be done in terms of establishing, you know, how useful are they and in what settings.
So, what do you want to find out in the near future?
The holy grail is to find a cure for Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia. It causes about 60 to 70% of cases, and it robs people of their memories and so much more than just memory. And it really essentially eventually robs people of their identities. And the holy grail is to find a cure or a treatment for it. And we haven't been successful yet, although we've made incredible advances. Yeah, but that's probably the single biggest discovery that we have not yet made that will change the quality of life for people with dementia.
And many of our listeners probably heard about the recent drug aducanumab that was approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So are we getting any closer with this?
So, yeah, so it's obviously a very controversial topic. So it turns out, you know, what did Alzheimer's discover originally in the early 1900s? He looked at the brain of someone who had memory loss, and he found two structures that we now talk about. One is called plaques that looks sort of like a spray-painted dot, and the other is called tangles, and that looks sort of like a little piece of spaghetti inside of neurons. And we now know that the plaques are made of a protein called amyloid, and the tangles are made of a protein called tau. And it turns out that amyloid builds up about 10 to 15 years before symptoms of Alzheimer's disease start. And it builds up all over the brain. It just sort of drapes the brain. And then tau tends to build up along with the actual symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And so because of that, and for some other reasons as well, for a long time, people have thought that if we could just get rid of amyloid, we could sort of stop the process. We could prevent the train from leaving the station. And so people invented all of these medications that cleaned up amyloid. And aducanumab is one of the strongest of this type of medications. And we know from good studies that if you give someone who has amyloid in the brain, if you give them aducanumab, it's really good at cleaning up the amyloid. But it turns out that we don't know that that actually changes their symptoms. And so with the company that made aducanumab, they did these two huge trials, each with more than 1,000 people. And they ended up stopping the trials early because they thought the drug didn't work. And then when they went back and evaluated the data, they noticed that in people who got the highest dose of the medication, if they filter it out some sort of a small sort of subpopulation of people, there seemed to be maybe a signal that the drug was helping. And so based on that and based on the sort of idea that cleaning up amyloid should help, the FDA went on to approve the medication. But it was very controversial because the data wasn't of the quality that we usually think of when we approve medications. And this is a high stakes game because there are millions of people with the disease and it's really expensive to treat them. So if we're gonna use these medications, we wanna know that they work. And so it turned out that lots of people who had advised the FDA who had felt like the data was not rigorous and was not convincing enough, several people stepped down. And ultimately, when Medicare went to decide whether or not they were going to pay for the medication, they essentially decided they're only going to pay for it for people who are involved in a research study. And so at this point, the way that we talk to patients about the medication is this, as we say, you know, it's sort of still in a research phase in the sense that we don't yet know if it works. And so if you're someone who would have wanted to participate in a research study, then it's not unreasonable to, you know, to join the study where it's going to be covered. But if you're someone who says, you know, I only want to take a medication if it's been proven to help and if we're sure that it's going to help, then it's probably not yet the time to be taking a medication like that.
And what about the preventative approaches? So you've spoken about the drugs and the molecules. So are we starting to think more about the lifestyle choices that we can make in order to have the healthy brain?
Yeah, so it turns out we actually know a lot about lifestyle changes that can affect the brain. So the four things that we tell our patients are this. So some of the best data is for exercise, something like 30 to 40 minutes a day, 4 days a week of something aerobic, so something that gets your heart rate up. Brisk walking, a recumbent bike, something like that. And it turns out that has an impressive effect on normal aging and also, we think, slows down the evolution of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease. There was an amazing study of people who had a genetic mutation that causes a different type of dementia. And it turned out that the people who were sort of the top exercises progressed about 50% slower than the people who didn't really exercise. So it just has this immense effect. Other than that, there's some data that, something like the Mediterranean diet also is good for cognition and it slows down cognitive loss. It's difficult to study diet. You can imagine, you probably couldn't tell me what you ate yesterday. I can't tell you exactly what I ate yesterday. And if I was in a study where they told me to eat certain things, I probably wouldn't follow the rules. So it's really hard to study diet versus exercise. You know, you can have someone show up for a class and you've proven that they've exercised. Yeah. And the other two things are social and intellectual engagement. And there's great data dating back decades that the more sort of social points of contact that you have, the slower people decline. And intellectually, there isn't perfect data for any particular activity. What we really tell folks is that they should choose something that they enjoy. So if you like Sudoku, that's great. If you like reading a magazine, that's just as good. But if you like listening to music, that's great. The key is just something that's engaging so that you're not watching TV all day.
So thinking about the bigger picture, so taking into account both these things, so trying to prevent the aging-related disorders of the brain with their lifestyle changes, but also trying to find this holy grail of the drug that can cure some of these conditions, what would be the impact on our society if we do or we don't find these sort of solutions?
So I think if we don't find solutions, it's quite staggering. So there is data that I want to say it's by 2050 that the number of people with dementia will triple. It's a huge burden of disease. And care for people with dementia, at least in the United States, is sort of woefully underfunded. It's extraordinarily expensive. And what often happens is that family members end up quitting their jobs to take care of their aging relatives. And that also, then affects the next generation. And so it's just a horribly broken system in its current state. And if we can find a cure for it, that not only will relieve the patients who are actually, would have suffered the symptoms, but also relieves their family members. It allows them to continue being productive members of the workforce. It allows them to keep sort of preserving the memory of those people so that their grandchildren will be able to capture those experiences and pass them on to the next generation.
This sounds such a huge problem, doesn't it? And such a tough nut to crack. But looking at the stories that you feature in your book, it leaves you hopeful that even some of the very complex diseases can be sort of cracked in the end. So, do you have a lot of hope for the future?
I do, and Galina, I'm glad to hear you say that. So, I think I feel hopeful for the future. When I initially wrote the book, some of the feedback I got was that it was not hopeful, and I realized I had sort of conveyed the wrong message. So I'm glad that the right one seems to have sort of come through in the final version, because it's really meant to be a hopeful book. Most of the conditions that I write about actually have cures now. 100 years ago, all of these conditions were deadly. And now most of them, we actually have treatments. It's pretty incredible the progress that we've made. And even though there are these big projects that we have not solved, we've been incredibly successful. And we know more about some of these conditions than we ever did. Even something like Alzheimer's disease, until recently, the only way that you could figure out if someone had amyloid and tau proteins in their brain was at autopsy after they died. So it was this terrible thing where you would say, I think this is what your disease is, but I can't prove it to you until you die. And now we actually have tools to take pictures of people's brains and prove that amyloid or tau proteins are building up in their brain. And this is while they're still alive. And that's incredible, not only for diagnosis, but also for choosing who we want to enroll in research trials for Alzheimer's disease. Until we had these tools, it was very difficult to figure out who had Alzheimer's disease and who didn't. So finding a drug that treated it was particularly complicated because we didn't know who to put in these research trials. And now we can be far more specific. So we've made these huge strides.
And what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, A Molecule Away from Madness, surprised you the most?
I think I didn't know any of the stories of these scientists. I had no concept of the people who were behind these diseases. Yeah, and the stories are just remarkable. There's, you know, the guy who figured out that the nervous system is made of multiple cells and not just one cell. He was this Spanish researcher who was working in his laboratory, made this big discovery, and didn't know how to communicate it to the world. And so he ended up paying to print up copies of his research. He spent so much money that they couldn't hire a nanny. So his wife is stuck doing all the childcare because he spent all his money printing up his research. He sends it all around Europe, expecting people to come back and say, you know, what an amazing discovery. But he doesn't hear anything. And he realizes, oh my gosh, you know, I wrote it in Spanish. I bet they don't understand Spanish. So he decides he has to actually go see these folks in person. So he packs his microscope, he packs his slides, brings them to a conference in Germany, and ends up setting up a booth, and he sets up these slides underneath the microscopes. And the people that start lining up at the beginning are sort of doubtful, but eventually the sort of head honchos of the sort of prominent people at the conference end up seeing the slides and believing him. And that's how we, you know, as a scientific world, figured out that the nervous system is made of multiple cells. So these stories are just amazing of these scientists who had to work so hard to convince the world of what they thought was correct.
So earlier on, you mentioned that the landscape of this sort of scientific landscape is changing in terms of diversity and representation. So how important to you is it to have more sort of female representatives in sciences?
So I think there's been a huge push lately, but to try to increase diversity in the sciences, and that's a push that's been made at the university level, in journals, in scholarships. Yeah, and this is I think a different world than we were in even 5 years ago, and I think we're sort of slowly starting to see the effects of that. And we're learning that it's really helpful for people to have mentors who come from similar backgrounds, and that's key. And I think that in particular, the role of mentorship in increasing diversity and increasing access to the sciences is critical. And I think we're getting better at that.
And what about representation of scientists in media? So if you watch a movie but it has scientists in it, do you normally scream at the screen saying, like, that is wrong?
So there are some times when, you say, oh my gosh, how did they ever, get someone to sign off on this? In particular, there are depictions of dementia that some of which can just be you cringe when you watch them. But others are better done. And, I think it's hard in the media to get things right. I think a lot of productions end up having, a scientist on board or someone to sign off on things. The classic picture of a neurologist in the media is someone who's, aloof and sort of totally out of touch with social graces. And I always get sad seeing that because I think actually, at least the neurology department where I am, the people are wonderful and warm and kind. So they sometimes get a bad rap in the media.
And as you're a neurologist, I just have to ask, so do you follow the Mediterranean diet?
Well, I have a 4-year-old and a 9-month-old, so I mostly follow the cereal diet. So no, I probably don't take my own advice. And I talk to patients often that, we tell them the ideal of what they should do. And then at some point that gets translated into reality. And not a single patient does everything I tell them to do. And that's normal.
Oh, that's great to hear. So the rest of us can have that second piece of cake with a very life conscious.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we all forget medications from time to time. And, one thing that we talk about with patients in clinic is, are you missing medications? Do you have extra pills left in the bottle at the end of the month? And you have to have some grace period or some leeway to give them, a chance to miss some medications because it's human.
That's great to hear. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what will be your next project or a book?
So I'm hoping to write another book. I have a few ideas that I'm thinking of, but I'm not sure which direction I'll go next. And then I have a small thought of trying to write a children's book, although I know there are so many people who write adult books and then try to write a children's book and it fails miserably. But so I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to write next, but I'm looking forward to doing it.
Our children are the harshest critics.
Exactly. But at least I have in-house ones, so.
And what would be the best way for our listeners to look up your work and also to learn more about your book?
So thanks so much for asking. So the easiest is to look at my website. So it's saramanningpeskin.com. So it's S-A-R-A. MANNINGPESKIN. So it's saramanningpeskin.com. Or if you look the book up, it's A Molecule Away from Madness, Tales of the Hijacked Brain.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Kavita, for having me. This is such a treat.